Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on the Conversation. It is Monday, June 9th. Today, we get to know the new FBI special agent in charge of the Hawaii and the Pacific region. U.S. News and World Report ranks Arizona State University number one in innovation for the last decade. What makes ASU click in Hawaii? We hear from a local mixologist who is a finalist for a new James Beard Award. And we reflect on the experiences of lesbians in Hawaii 3 decades after a documentary first told their stories. Plus, the U.S. Army turns 250 years old this week. We consider innovations on the battlefield, warfare over time. What's changed? You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Ke aloha, English, Cullen, and more. These high public corruption stories involving Hawaii's police chief and state lawmakers dominated the headlines and are just a few cases that we mentioned today credited to FBI probes in recent years. And an international investigation into online threats to children netted multiple arrests, including a cult member living on the Big Island. With new leadership in the White House and the FBI, will we see a shift in priorities? We thought it would be a good time to get to know the special agent in charge of Hawaii's field office. David Porter is new to the job in the islands and comes from a legal background. He dropped by our studio last week.
I've been FBI agent for almost 19 years now. I started in the Pittsburgh field office on our Joint Terrorism Task Force there, JTTF, and we have a JTTF in every field office, all 55 field offices across the country. Some field offices, depending on their size, have multiple JTTFs, but I started doing that sort of work in Pittsburgh, then transferred back to my home state in Michigan to the Detroit field office, where I was also on the JTTF there. And as a street agent, as we call it, I continued to work counterterrorism matters. I was on the SWAT team in the Detroit office. I'd been on the SWAT team in the Pittsburgh office. And I am a lawyer by training, practiced law in Michigan for about 4.5 years and worked in the Hill in D.C. for about 1.5 years. I was counsel to a U.S. Senate committee. So I had a legal background, and I was asked by management in Detroit to serve for a while in our legal office, our legal unit. Every field office has a legal unit, chief division counsel and associate division counsel. I was asked to be associate division counsel in ADC in Detroit, which I did for a while. That led to my first supervisory experience when I took on the challenge of Detroit's public corruption and civil rights squad, where I directly managed all of the federal public corruption and civil rights cases that the office in Detroit had, which for the most part consisted of the significant work that we had in Wayne County, Michigan. And some of that work certainly goes back decades and is fairly well known. Learned a lot in that capacity as a squad supervisor. Fortunate enough as a young supervisor to have very seasoned agents that were on the squad and task force officers or TFOs. They taught me a great deal. And I did that for about 4.5 years and absolutely loved the work and the commitment to the community in those lines of effort there. I then went to Washington, D.C. for my first stint at our headquarters, where I worked out of our counterintelligence division and on a task force that was combined with all of our operational divisions there. Did that for about 1.5 years. That, generally speaking, an 18-month headquarters stint like that is something that we have to do, right, to get additional responsibility in our organization. So I did that, came back to Detroit, and very soon thereafter was promoted to an assistant special agent in charge. We call them ASACs. And I was fortunate enough for the first time in a long time at that point to be able to go back to what was home for me, which was Grand Rapids, Michigan, for both my wife and I. Good to get back with family. And I was the ASAC there responsible for the Western District of Michigan. In that role there, I was responsible for all FBI operations in 49 counties to include the Upper Peninsula up in Michigan. So I was on the road quite a bit. It's a little bit different than being on the road here. Not island hopping, but certainly windshield time. And did that for close to a couple years. Significantly enjoyed that work and then got pinged again to go back to headquarters where I worked out of the previous deputy director's office as his chief of staff for about a year and a half, which then led me to this job here where I've been for about 5 months.
So, yeah, well, what's your first impression of bringing those skills to bear in a community like this?
My first impression of the state was 5-6 years ago when my wife and I came here on a personal vacation with our youngest son. I didn't even get through 24 hours, Catherine, of being here, and told my wife, I think we're in trouble because I want to be here. I love everything about this place, the culture. Of course, it's gorgeous, right? And the diversity that's here of people from all over the world. I feel like I was hearing languages from everywhere, right? And just really, really fell in love with that and said, I told my wife, I don't know how we're going to make it back here. Maybe it's after retirement sort of thing, but certainly blessed towards the end of my last headquarters stint to see that this was a distinct possibility with Stephen Merrill, the previous special agent in charge for this office here in Honolulu, leaning towards retirement. And the timing worked out. Told my wife, and she was on board, very excited. And this was the only SAC job that I applied for. I didn't apply for anything else. I'm exactly where I want to be.
With the timing of this, we have a new administration, and I don't know what you can share about the priorities that have come down about what your office will look at.
Sure. Structurally, we have a set of national priorities that are identified and communicated enterprise-wide by principally and foremost the director and the deputy director, and every field office in its area of responsibility, or AOR as we refer to it, then has a certain amount of autonomy, levity, discretion to adjust those priorities for the threats and the criminal activity that you see in the area that you are responsible for. So the area that I am responsible for is the state of Hawaii, Guam, Saipan, and American Samoa. Take the leadership, our FBI leadership priorities, and focus on those in light of what we see here. So the mission of the FBI is, Catherine, is very simple. It's protect the American people and uphold the Constitution. I say that all the time. Those are words that are on the wall of many field offices. They're over headquarters or on a bunch of our materials to remind us of what is truly important. So that's first and foremost. And cascading from that mission are a set of priorities that Director Patel came out to us in field leadership positions, things that we need to focus on, must focus on, and many of those things are threats and mission sets that we've looked at for a long time. And some we are emphasizing a lot more on now than we were in the past, which I think is a good thing.
I'm just thinking recently we've had a lot of high-profile public corruption cases that you folks were involved at with the police chief or state lawmakers, and we hear that protecting our borders is going to be a big deal, as is protecting children against internet crime. But you folks have already been, like I said, doing a lot of this work.
We have. And but you speak to a few things that you're right, we have done and we will continue to, right? We have our national security or defend the homeland mission sets, right? Counterterrorism, counterintelligence, significant cyber-related activity, particularly emanating from a foreign sovereign that present national security concerns, have always been and will always be a significant focus of the FBI. Violent crime is an objective that the director has made very clear is a priority of his and will be a priority of ours. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a police chief. I've talked to all of them, got great relationships with the ones here in the state, but if you talk on the mainland, police chiefs or sheriffs that don't like the sound of that priority, right? Violent crime is something that exists everywhere and impacts everybody's life, right? And violent criminal actors, their transnational organized crime. But within that, we also have an objective to protect the most vulnerable among us in our violent crimes against children program. Every field office has it. Every field office focuses on it. Unfortunately, this problem exists everywhere. You can't escape this, particularly with the way in which the internet is used to facilitate these predators' actions. And that is certainly something that we focus on along with all the other field offices on the mainland. Rebuilding public trust is another priority rebuilding and maintaining the public's trust. And you mentioned public corruption. Those violations, public corruption, civil rights, white-collar crime, sophisticated fraud and activity, things like that, are a part of that. And the director is also emphasizing fierce organizational accountability, as it's been stated to us. And that's to the communities that we serve. For me, I look at that as also the employees that I have the privilege of leading and serving now. Also, our congressional oversight committees and everything within Washington, D.C. that holds us accountable to meeting our mission sets.
We've been reading a lot about how there have been cuts in the department. There's a lot of very experienced and institutional memory that the FBI has lost. But then we're hearing there's also a move to put agents out in the field versus in D.C. in the nation's capital. What's the snapshot here in Hawaii? Have we lost? Are we gaining any agents?
Without providing specific numbers and things like that, I can tell you there have been not only agents, but analytics staff and professional staff personnel across the country in all the field offices and headquarters that have accepted the federal government's offer, right, in terms of the deferred resignation program. And we have experienced some of that. But you also mentioned the focus upon pushing resources out to the field. And that is certainly true. Won't get into specific numbers. Don't know exactly where they're at. But our offices will be the beneficiary of seeing personnel pushed to us to address and focus on some of the things that I referenced earlier.
And then you mentioned that you also are in charge of the Pacific area. We've heard of federal agencies being shut down and then having the offices here in Hawaii take over. Is that happening? Can you mention about that at all?
I can't speak to that. I can say here the area that the FBI Honolulu field office is responsible for, again, is the state. And we have a significant number of resources on island here in Oahu and Kapolei. We also have investigative personnel and analytic personnel on the Big Island and on Maui. But then additional resources that are in Guam and Saipan. We are unique in many respects, and we are the same in many respects. I spoke of some of the challenges that every area faces, violent crime, right? The targeting by predators against our children. We have a very unique area of responsibility here, obviously being in the Pacific and where we are located and the significant military presence that is here. And then the normal sets of sort of national security concerns and threats that go along with something like that.
Anything else that you want to underscore just about the work ahead out here in Hawaii and the priorities that the administration may have handed down? I don't know if there's anything on homeland security or immigration.
Every field office has been tasked with assisting our Department of Homeland Security partners in immigration enforcement. We have engaged in that here, providing assistance, and our field offices have done that on the mainland as well, something that we will continue to do. But in terms of a personal commitment here, I'm here because I want to be, very much want to be. And this is my home now. And I'm committed to waking up every day to protecting the American people that live here and upholding the Constitution here, right? And protecting our children from online predators here and working to secure faith and trust in public servants here. Those things are very important to me, and I know they're important to our communities. So I'm all in, Catherine.
Okay. That's good to know. All right. But thank you so much, David Porter. We appreciate you carving out time for us.
Sure thing.
That was Dave Porter, the new FBI special agent in charge of the Hawaii field office, who dropped by our studios last week.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii. R&B singer-songwriter Leela James performs songs such as Fall For You and Complicated this Wednesday and Thursday in two sets nightly. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
This Saturday, Hawaii Public Radio's Live from the Atherton presents Noel Okimoto's Hō'ihi. Enjoy live jazz performances with HPR every Saturday in June. Learn more at hprtickets.org, sponsored by HMSA.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
Arizona State University has had a presence in the islands for more than a decade. So what does a landlocked state have in common with the Hawaiian Islands? Reef conservation isn't something you just write off would think would be a good fit. But the university's approach to science is what has grabbed attention. The ASU has been ranked number one in innovation for a decade now, and that modern take has helped its programs find a home in the islands. ASU Provost and Vice President Nancy Gonzalez just wrapped up a visit to Hawaii. She stopped by our studios to talk about the connection between Hawaii and ASU.
Relationship is a great way to refer to it because that is indeed what it is. And it's evolved over time, probably for more than a decade, and there are many aspects to it. One is we have a connection through people. We've had over 4,300 students who were from the Hawaiian Islands who over the years have come and studied with us at ASU. And we maintain strong connections with our students and wish to continue to work with them and serve them in many ways. And many have returned back to the islands. I think a big part of it, though, is also that the Hawaiian Islands are such a unique place in terms of the ecosystem and the vast biodiversity and the kinds of issues that the islands are dealing with as we think about being good stewards of the planet and issues of sustainability and living in harmony with the planet. ASU actually has the first school of sustainability in the country, so we're very interested in those issues as well. So there's a natural partnership for us to be connected to the kinds of questions that you're all asking here. And we want to be able to lend our service, our expertise, you know, our technology to kind of be able to partner with the work that you're trying to pursue here, all of your communities are pursuing. But probably the biggest issue really is the type of university that we are. So for the past 20 years, ASU has been redefining itself as a new American university, which is very much in service, national service, to all the communities that we serve. And part of that is that we want to broaden access. And so we have a very inspiring charter that says that we measure ourselves by whom we include, not by whom we exclude, and how they succeed. And so this broad mission of inclusion really extends far beyond the borders of our own state. We also are very committed to using the best of research, scholarship, and education to advance communities and to really tackle the grand challenges that we face as a global community. And then finally, we are aiming to always serve the health and well-being and economic and cultural well-being of our communities. And so since we do have a relationship, we find that it's our responsibility to be able to be of service. And so we're here to serve in whatever ways our partners here are interested in having us engage.
It sounds like this sense of caring is almost like shared values.
Shared values, absolutely. We believe that the knowledge and the expertise of universities should be given, and it should really be used in ways that we can address problems that we face all over the world.
And we have featured the good work of Greg Asner and his team there on the Big Island with the innovative research that they're doing to help protect our coral reefs.
Yeah.
And that has gotten national, international attention, really.
Absolutely. And their work is really the perfect example of what we're trying to do at ASU. And they're very much focused on conservation science and coral reef health and the kinds of issues that are so important here in the Hawaiian Islands. So they're a great example. You know, we think that the work that they're doing can be a model for what others might do, you know, in other places and addressing additional issues beyond what they're doing.
And this notion of using technology, it's pushing the envelope. It's innovative.
Absolutely. yes, we think of it as being good stewards of the planet and really thinking about our relationship to the planet going forward. What are all the ways that we need to not just use technology, but to do it in partnership with communities and their own knowledge systems to create a better way to make sure we're making ethical decisions moving forward that will be sustainable for all of us.
And I understand that ASU has gotten some recognition for its innovation.
Absolutely, yes. We have been ranked number one in innovation for 10 years in a row by U.S. News and World Report. And that comes as a result of the fact that we have been redefining ourselves and been pushing the boundaries, as you say, to try to not just have excellent scholars, but to have excellent scholars that are engaged in finding new solutions. So it's very futuristic, forward thinking. And we really push all of ourselves to do that. And we push all of ourselves to do that in the education realm as well. We know that rates of college going and college achievement are not what they should be in the country. And we also know that there have been many students who have pursued college degrees but never graduated. That's just inexcusable. And so what we're constantly trying to do is push ourselves to figure out how can we correct those errors of the past? How can we provide more pathways to more students to be able to succeed in advancing themselves? Because, you know, the world of the future is going to require people who are prepared through education and the ability to be learners and advance themselves. So that's very much that push to combine access, which is serving everybody broadly with the most excellent education one can provide, is, I think, what drives us to be so innovative.
So what's next for ASU out here in Hawaii?
Yeah, well, one of the things that we want to be very focused on is where can we support others who are trying to educate the people of Hawaii? And that could be through K-12, that could be through college pathways. And that would be in partnership with other schools. We do have a partnership with Kamehameha Schools. And currently, we're trying to bring educational access or assets to rural communities, working on the Big Island and Maui and Kauai. And, you know, we're here to provide whatever they might need. In some cases, it's teacher training and upskilling. In other cases, it's, you know, we have very sophisticated and well-developed online education. So if there's ways that we can provide that education to advance more students, particularly in areas that they don't have access to yet, we're really here to serve where it's needed and to fill in gaps.
You know, we recently had on our show and in our studios the head of the Kamala Marine Lab over at the University of Hawaii. Bob Richmond talked about the sense of, you know, sharing knowledge and teaching the islanders from across the Pacific about their world and their island, and they are now running the marine science programs on their home islands, which is terrific because it just empowers them.
Absolutely. That's a great example. And there may be other areas where people imagine individuals of all ages, it could even be older adults who are wanting to retrain, could get supports to be able to move in new directions, and we are here to design whatever our partners might want us to help with.
Talk about the maybe some of the ethics behind some of this innovation. You know, sometimes just because we can do it doesn't mean we should do it.
That's exactly right. And actually, that's a phrase that we often use. We have introduced a design principle into our university in the last couple of years that we call a principled innovation. So we absolutely push ourselves to be at the forefront of innovation in all sorts of realms, you know, whether it's in, you know, biotechnology or in advancing the microelectronics industry or health advances. But just because you can innovate doesn't necessarily mean that you should. You really need to think downstream of the implications of what you're doing and try to innovate in ways that won't cause damage to people or damage to the planet in the future. And so we're really pushing ourselves to integrate that into the thinking of all that we're doing and in all of our work with our communities.
And you talked about who you include versus who you exclude. But given the political climate that we're living in today, I mean, it's reality, and universities are under extreme pressure to toe the line with this administration. So how are you looking at this?
Yeah, that's a great question. From our perspective, we have for the past 20 years been very much focused on access. So if somebody is prepared for college, they gain admission to our university. So we haven't been using any kind of affirmative action or admissions quotas or anything like that. We've really broadened the aperture to invite all in. And so that is our response to this issue of whether or not you can be selective and exclusive and target particular groups. We think all groups need opportunity and that talent exists in all neighborhoods across the world. And so we want to provide pathways for everybody in. That's been our response.
That was Nancy Gonzalez, Arizona State University's Vice President and Provost, who dropped by to talk about strengthening the relationship with communities across the state.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
The nation's top food award names its winners next Monday, and a Hawaii mixologist is in the running. The James Beard Awards honor the top restaurants and chefs from across the country, and while there were 9 semifinalists from Hawaii named back in January, only one made it to the final round. David Newman is a co-owner of Pint and Jigger in Honolulu. He is one of 5 national finalists in a new category, Outstanding Professional in Cocktail Service. HPR's Jason Ubai spoke with Newman at his craft beer and cocktail bar inside the Ala Moana Hotel.
I started bartending when I was 19, and 30 years later, I'm still doing it. You know, when I first started bartending, it definitely wasn't looked at as a career. I think maybe 10 years ago, it really transitioned to where people could make a legitimate career.
Why did you start Pint and Jigger?
So I moved here in 2007 with Nobu. I had transferred out from Malibu location, and then we opened the Nobu in Waikiki. And there was just really a need for craft cocktail scene to be developed more in Hawaii. We were trying to fill a niche. At the time, that literally nowhere in the entire United States were both craft cocktails and craft beer in the same place. Those two sets of drinkers were always separated. You had a craft beer bar or, you know, brewery, and you had craft cocktail bars. They were not combined, and we had the idea to combine those. And it worked out really, really well, because the biggest complaint, I think, for people in craft cocktail bars is waiting too long to get a drink. If 30% of your guests or 40% of your guests are drinking beer, the longest it takes to pour a beer is like 30 seconds to a minute for a Guinness. So it worked out really well.
Well, you're talking about one of the first places in the country combining craft cocktails and craft beer. Maybe let's talk about craft cocktails. What's your philosophy on cocktails and service?
So the craft cocktail movement followed on the heels of farm to table. It didn't make much sense if you were concerned about the provenance of your food, whether it was organic, sustainable, where it was grown, how it was taken care of, to then go and order a margarita that was made with bottled sour mix that had high fructose corn syrup and red and yellow number 3. So it just made sense that eventually cocktails caught up to food. So I was really fortunate, because I was working for Nobu in Malibu, and they were a little bit ahead of the curve. They weren't as concerned with the costing of a drink, what it would cost them. I remember I made a blood orange cocktail for them, and when the season ended, I was like, well, we'll have to take that off the menu. I'm like, no, we'll just order the blood oranges from Chile. And they shipped them in specifically to keep that cocktail on the menu. So we got a little bit of a head start on the craft cocktail scene, because, you know, that was 2004. Didn't really blow up until, you know, 5 or 6 years after that. And then in Hawaii, not until like 2012.
Why do you think you were picked for this award?
I mean, 30 years in the industry helps for sure. But I think Hawaii Food and Wine had a lot to do with it. You know, I've been participating in that for almost 13 years. And you are rubbing shoulders with, you know, chefs that have gotten beard awards or nominated. And, you know, a lot of them, you know, Pint and Jigger had gotten a reputation. So a lot of more visiting here. And, you know, I think that just kind of spreads. I mean, I show up every day trying to make sure that our guests have just a really unique and great experience and take a lot of pride in the hospitality we give. And, you know, at this point, 30 years in, I got a few tricks on my sleeve, and I knew we've created some really unique offerings, and I think the combination of everything. So I'm totally blown away. I was not expecting that, you know, new category, and yeah, it's pretty crazy.
With 30 years of experience, what surprises you today, and like what changes have you seen? What still excites you to come into work every day?
The surprise is that things are so cyclical. Things that I was making 30 years ago are now back in fashion. You know, one of our most popular drinks now is an espresso martini, and we were making those 30 years ago. They disappeared for 20 years, and here we are again. So that's surprising. I still absolutely love what I do. I feel really blessed to have been able to create a space for myself with my partners to really continue to enjoy, like I said, creating cocktails. And that's probably the most exciting thing for me is we have a lot of guests now that come in and they just do what we call a bartender's choice. It's called a bartender's whimsy other places or dealer's choice. And we just have a conversation and try to figure out the perfect cocktail for you to drink at that moment. And it's really neat because a lot of those guests on different days are interested in drinking something totally different. And it's really neat to see our guests have become incredibly knowledgeable. So it's a lot more challenging.
How would you describe your guest?
I think that's the best part about Pint and Jigger. You know, we're still, even in, you know, being located in the Ala Moana Hotel after we moved here from King Street, we're still over 80% local, which is pretty crazy being in a hotel, but our following followed us over. Our guests are really loyal. And the really neat part for me is that it's everything from 21-year-olds to senior citizens, which is really cool. And we get the full gamut of guests. You get a lot of Neighbor Island guests that are over in town for whatever reason, and them stopping by is really cool. So yeah, I love taking care of our locals the best.
The award had some interesting criteria. I can feel like the setting high standards and consistency and excellence, that's all makes sense. But making efforts to create a sustainable work culture, can you talk about that? I know food and beverage has a notorious reputation. So what are you doing here at Pint and Jigger to improve work culture?
I mean, when you guys walked in today, we're right in the middle of a staff training, and it's just something we take an incredible amount of pride on, you know, having a ton of knowledge with the staff, not just myself. But I think the sustainable work culture is just, you know, my willingness to share everything with anybody. If you came in here and you're like, I really like this cocktail, I'd give you the recipe and tell you exactly how to make it. And we've had so many bartenders come through Pint. So we opened in 2012 that have gone on to run really amazing other programs. And it's that family tree. And that's really what makes it sustainable. It's like Kuale's out in Manoa killing it at Lady Elaine and Little Plum. And our guy Curtis went and opened Hanakoa for the mezzanine bar. And Quinn went to open the original Encore. And Ari is over there running the program at Brick Fire. And these are just all Pint and Jigger veterans, and there's a ton more. And it's just really cool to see everybody that's come through here is going out to different places, not just in Hawaii, but Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, and they're just killing it.
What's your favorite drink?
The business side of me, the most popular drink we have ever created is called a sous vide old fashioned. We take a used barrel, break that down, or use barrel chips from a used whiskey barrel, rechar those, and then slow cook an old fashioned in it for 2 days. It's our most popular cocktail, something that I created, and we've sold tens of thousands. It's pretty cool. But my favorite drink I've ever created is called a Drawn and Quartered, and it's definitely not for everybody. It has an ounce of Angostura bitters in it, an ounce of Campari, an ounce of lime juice, and an ounce of a house-made apricot simple syrup. And it's tart, it's bitter, it's sweet. It's just really cool because it's super unique.
And then you said you had a staff meeting earlier. What's the bartender's choice today?
So the way we do things is a little crazy. We'll take a cocktail that everybody's really familiar with, say like a Negroni, simple, equal part, three ingredients, gin, Campari, sweet vermouth, but we don't think that's the best possible iteration of that drink. So we will grab six different gins, five different sweet vermouths, we will make that drink over and over again with those different combinations, and then we will start changing proportions. So our house Negroni is based on myself and my entire staff's agreement on what the best possible Negroni is. And the really cool part about that is that every time they serve it, they know, because they've tried 45 different iterations on a Tuesday with me, that's the best possible Negroni they can make for our guests. And we all agree on it, and that becomes the house Negroni. So today we were retooling a few cocktails and then working on an upcoming menu change. So we'll have the staff present cocktails that they think are menu worthy, and then we'll tear them apart and see how we can make them better. And everybody gets input, and you know, it's a time to put your pride aside and try to actually create something to be the best for our guests.
That was Dave Newman, a co-owner of Pint and Jigger in Honolulu and Hawaii's only James Beard Award finalist this year. He spoke with HPR's Jason Ubai. Newman finds out if he has won a National James Beard Award next Monday.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
Living out and proud more than three decades ago, filmmakers Sarah Banks and Kate Samble released the documentary Out in Paradise in 1993. The film focused on the stories of 30 women who at the time were living their lives as lesbians in Hawaii. The screening of the documentary tomorrow night helps kick off the Honolulu Rainbow Film Festival. The Conversation C.W. Gibson spoke with the two filmmakers about how things have and haven't changed since the documentary was first released.
I felt it was important for the LGBT to be able to share their story and who they are. And with that understanding, it can change. Once they know who you are, it's harder to dismiss you. It's harder to hate you. There's a kind of an acceptance that happens.
Yeah, in some ways, the film feels like an act of humanizing, bringing right. people to life. Kate, you mentioned that it was difficult getting people to participate in the film.
Well, we asked people to sign a release form, giving us full access to their interview and being able to air it. So that was scary for a lot of people. But most importantly, we wanted to show the diversity of lesbians in Hawaii.
There are 30 women featured in the film. Sarah, tell me about an individual or individuals that stay with you all these years later that you still think about in terms of making an impact on just your memory.
When I think about it, I think about Shay. And Shay is in a nursing home right now, and she's got Alzheimer's. And it's really sad because she was just such a powerful woman.
What did Shay bring to the film?
She was just this an ER doc and feisty, and she saw herself as a comedian, and besides being just this incredible athlete, and she just, yeah, bigger than life.
Yeah, in the opening montage of the film, there's a shot of Shay riding her bike up Tantalus. She used to live at the top of Tantalus, and she would ride her bike up there. And she surfed into the 80s. She was in a PBS documentary called Surfing for Life, because she was in her 80s and still surfing. When she was a child growing up, people would say, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up? And she'd go, I want to be a doctor. And they go, oh, you mean a nurse? And she goes, no, damn it, I want to be a doctor. And sure enough, she became a doctor.
Well, obviously, Shay stays with the two of you. Anyone else, Kate, for you that stays in your memory all these years later?
Jackie and Margaret, they met when they were in their 50s at a Bible study class. And they were both married at the time to men. And they fell in love and divorced their husbands. But they remained friends with their husbands. I think that's something that's kind of unique about lesbians, is that a lot of us just remain friends with people that we've been involved with, people we've had long-term relationships with. And my philosophy is, once I love someone, I'm going to continue to love them. So I think for the lesbian community, it's important for us to maintain a sense of connectedness, because we are so isolated and we are such a minority. And that's one of the factors that unfortunately attributes to a lot of older lesbians living in poverty right now, because back in the day, they weren't making as much money as men were. And because we weren't allowed to marry back then, we can't collect our partner's retirement fund. And we have lower social security payments because we weren't making as much money. So a lot of lesbians live in poverty, sadly, older lesbians.
The two of you were making a film about a community to which you belonged and which you knew well. That said, did you learn anything while making the film?
The bottom line is that it really depends on the parents' acceptance of their child. And they have to get past any angst that they have about their child is not accepted in society. When I was struggling in high school, the priest from our church came and visited me because I took a bunch of pills and I went to Castle Hospital. And so he said to me, "Sarah, you know what? As much as you can't accept yourself and it's causing you so much pain, your parents can't either. So the more that you can accept yourself and love yourself, then it'll be so much easier for them." And that turned my life around at that moment. At that point, I said, you know what? I can't have try to kill myself. God loves me just the way I am. And God made me just the way I am. So get over it, Mom and Dad. And get over it, Sarah.
I was just going to say, in some ways, it feels like making the film seems to me like an act of acceptance all its own. Inviting them to come forward is an act of acceptance.
Yeah, there's a fabulous organization in California called the Trevor Project, and they focus on suicide. They have a suicide hotline for gay LGBTQI youth. And there are 4 times attempted suicides in the young gay community than there are in the heterosexual community. And they've discovered that the main difference between people who want to kill themselves and people that don't is that people that are accepting of themselves and live in a community and have family who supports them, that is the big difference. Also, in rural isolated communities, only 34% of the people, the youth that live in isolated rural communities, feel accepted versus 67% of people that live in more urban populated areas and whose parents are accepting of them. So that's a really big factor. And for a lot of the women in our video who came out in the 70s and 80s, they weren't accepted. And so they felt extremely isolated.
Talk about that, Sarah, because I know that, as Kate just said, when you made the film, a lot of people were still closeted. And it seems like there was maybe this sort of bifurcation that was happening for individuals where they could maybe have a life of their own, where they could feel free to be who they were in certain social circles, but not in other circles, professional and so forth.
Yeah, because I couldn't walk down the street holding hands with a girl or another woman without repercussions. I worked at Hiltonwan Village. At that time, if they knew you were gay, you could lose your job. There was no protections whatsoever. There was this guy who was one of our dancers and had his picture on my desk. If anybody asked, I said, "That's my dear friend." And so they didn't ask anything more. I didn't say, "This is my lover" or anything. I'd let them make the assumptions. Actually, people came to me. I was in human resources and I was in charge of training. People came to me if they needed an employee assistance program, if they had a drug problem or some spouse abuse or whatever. And so it was really an important position, but I had to coach them and say, whatever you do, don't come out. Don't come out because you'll lose your job. And this is the way they're going to set it up, as if you can't do what they asked you to do. So they'll say incompetence. So just do the best that you can. And that was the landscape of that particular time. And thank goodness we have the protections now, except people are losing their jobs, federal jobs, in this current administration. So hence, some of the women that were out over 30 years ago aren't now.
There are so many different ways we can talk about how we've progressed since you've made this film. We have Everyone Has the Right to Marry Now, and we have legislation that has tried to bring us closer to equal pay for all, even though we know we're not there
right,
yet,
about 80
cents on the dollar for women. But it also seems like in some ways there are some elements of regression that we're seeing even more recently. Speak to that, Kate, in terms of the context of reaching out to women who were in this film all these years later to check in with them as you prepare for this screening. What kind of responses are you getting from people from the film all these years later?
Well, I'm really saddened and disappointed that a lot of women just don't dare to be out right now. One of the individuals has transitioned and identifies as a trans person. And when I reached out to them, they said, absolutely not. Because this current administration, they're trying to create fear. And unfortunately, they're succeeding.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you want listeners to know about the film?
Well, I think that the women in it are so open about their lives and how they evolved into being able to be open about their lives. Now, I swear almost every TV show has a lesbian married couple in it.
Right.
It's pretty amazing. When Sarah and I grew up, there were absolutely no role models. The first time I heard the word lesbian spoken out loud, I was in college and I was just freaked out. I think for youth now, it's probably a lot more challenging in some ways, even though they can come out. And if they have parents who are supportive and live in a progressive community, they'll probably feel very free to come out. But for young people living in isolated rural communities, it must be just petrifying for them. Because seeing people on TV, gay male couples and lesbian couples, they know that's a possibility. And wow, is that why I'm attracted to Karen and Susie instead of Johnny and Billy?
Right.
So I think that, like Sarah said, if we can teach young people to just accept who they are and love who they love, and if we can teach their parents to accept them, we'll have a much better society.
Love conquers all.
That was HBR's E.W. Gibson, who spoke with Sarah Banks and Kate Sample about their documentary, Out in Paradise. The film will be screened tomorrow night at 6 p.m. at the Hawaii Theater Center as part of the Honolulu Rainbow Film Festivals. For more information, check out our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
They say that in the army, the coffee's mighty fine. It looks like muddy water and tastes like turpentine. It looks like muddy water and tastes like turpentine. Oh Lord, I wanna go. Oh Lord, I wanna go. But they won't let me go.
This week, the U.S. Army turns 250 years old. The branch of the armed forces behind Land Power celebrates Heritage Week with activities that kicked off Sunday. The sounds of horses pounding across the field echoed across Polo Field at Fort Shafter. The tradition of a polo game that started in Hawaii decades ago, tied to an Army commander who would go on to become General George Patton. That's a flashback to one part of Army history in Hawaii. At LANPAC 2025, military top brass from 32 countries gathered in Waikiki last month to talk about land power. That got us wondering about changes on the battlefield over 250 years. Vendors exhibiting their ware tell a story. Consider your great-grandfather's army boots. One exhibitor offered options of footwear, lightweight, durable versions, breathable in the heat of tropics. Travel light, travel smart. Familiar with the invisibility cloak from the Harry Potter book series? Well, there is high-tech stealth fabric out there that essentially can shield troops from heat-sensing radar. Think of a smart camouflage blanket, one with the ability to hide a person's body heat to avoid detection from the enemy. All part of the mission to counter search and destroy. The price to manufacture what they called electro-optics, like thermal sensing devices or night vision, have dropped dramatically.
Thermal imaging you can now use during the day or the night. You can record. It's essentially digital smart technology that has come a long way. So really on our behalf, it's an education to our end users, our government, even on the commercial side. A lot of hunters, campers in the U.S. love thermal imaging because it has come such a long way. It is so affordable and you can use it both during the day and the night and seek and detect at much longer distances than you can with traditional night vision.
And the whole idea, though, with innovation and technology is that it may be not only lighter and more effective, but it's cheaper, like with television.
That's right. And a great analogy we like to use is like a flat screen TV. Flat screen TVs are wonderful, but they started off at about $5,000, and then they became $2,000. Now, a good TV is about $500 and better than ever before, much of the time, as is the case with thermal imaging.
And there's also high tech that stalls corrosion. Cocoon is a company whose innovation is to protect your big ticket assets, from planes to 3D printers, in use now at Wheeler Air Force Base, Kaneohe Marine Base, and the Hawaiian Air Hangar at the Honolulu Airport.
It's mastering the elements, right? You got to figure out how to handle what Mother Nature's throwing at you. So in the protective cover fabric, those are waterproof and air permeable so that you're not pulling condensation and creating a greenhouse under the cover.
And therefore, your investment won't rust.
That's right. Pretty much won't rust, won't mold or mildew, and you're preserving its life.
Today's warfare is mind-boggling. The headlines about exploding pagers in the battle with Hezbollah was a head-turner, as is fighting with drones. Such is the stuff playing out in the Ukraine-Russia conflict. There are unmanned aerial devices testing the limits in the real world. And rest assured, there is hardware and software all made in the good old USA. At LANPAC 2025, a historian hailed the battle in Luzon in the Philippines as pivotal in the war against the Japanese in World War II. In a keynote session, the commanding general of the Philippines, Roy Galito, described a David versus Goliath scenario with the threats of the People's Republic of China pushing in at its borders.
Modern land warfare instead emphasizes the ability to maneuver in complex environment, seize and dominate key terrains, and turn geography into a force multiplier. Essentially, it is shaped by elements which are often overlooked in great power calculations: intelligent use of force, adaptability, and positional advantage that any small state can muster to assert its place in the modern battlefield.
Here's more on Galito's point of view as a small state in changing warfare.
Choose the way you intend to fight and be really good at it, factoring one's unique competitive advantage. Small states should clearly choose how to intend to fight and strive to be really good at it. This means channeling time, energy, and resources to areas that matter most. Focus will allow even modestly equipped armies to generate outsized effects through training, discipline, leadership, and conceptual clarity. Without this clarity, small states will be doomed to wars they cannot fight or adopt technology they cannot sustain.
Such is the snapshot of land power, strategy, technology, something to consider as we reflect on past battles, current conflicts, and future wars. This week, the U.S. Army hosts a number of public events to mark its 250th anniversary. It ends with the Army Ball here on Oahu. We'll have links on our website later today. And on the 14th of June, we can expect a military parade in our nation's capital to cap the week off. And that is it for us today. Tomorrow, we hear about the latest in the round to cut funds for public media. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.